Hello and welcome to an Inside College Hockey Frozen Four podcast recorded April 6th, 2008. My name is Joe Gladyszewski, senior writer covering ECAC hockey and podcast host, joined by our panel, as always, Hockey East senior writer Jeff Howe, WCHA senior writer Jess Myers, and Inch editor and columnist Mike Eidelbus. We'll start with Bus, and we'll start with not an easy question, but one that'll start the discussion. Is Michigan a clear favorite this weekend?
You know, I'm going to go ahead and say that, yes, they are the clear favorite. You just look up and down their lineup. There really are no weaknesses, and even in the CCHA tournament, they started getting some production out of their third and fourth lines, which really were instrumental in how well they did at the CCHA tournament. Not as big of a factor, obviously, in the regional, but you know, I think top to bottom, there are no weaknesses in that roster. So yeah, I think you have to consider them a favorite. I think you can find an Achilles heel with every other team in the tournament outside of Michigan.
Jeff, you've seen the most Boston College of any of us. Tell us why they might win this weekend.
Well, they've got four really strong lines, you know, three of whom can score anytime they're on the ice. Obviously, they've got Nathan Gerby, who's a Hobie finalist, and their defense is really emerging. Nick Petrecki has... I mean, I don't know where he came from, but ever since the Beanpot, this kid has just been playing. Yeah. But he's become a monster on the blue line. I mean, he's really, you know, a freshman who's coming into his own, really physical player. Carl Sneap is another player who's playing a lot better on the blue line. You know, I like their defense a lot lately. Brendan's playing well. You know, name all six of their guys. Every single one of them's playing pretty well, for the most part. They have had a couple different letdowns at times, but, you know, nothing I would say is overly concerning, you know, as they head out to Denver. And then the big question mark heading into the tournament was John Muse, who is playing probably his best hockey of the season right now. He doesn't seem like the kind of kid who gets nervous or overly, you know, taken aback by the moment. He's had to answer questions like that all season, from can you be the next Corey Schneider to can you lead a team that is talented enough to win a national championship and, you know, not blow it, I guess, to say, to put it harshly. And he's played very well in the postseason. So you've got a team that's playing well in three areas, and you've got not the Hobie Baker finalist, but probably the most valuable player in the country in Nathan Gerby, who is playing at the top of his game right now. So BC, I can definitely see winning this thing.
I certainly can, too. It was good to see Nick Petrecki kind of grab the torch that was left behind by Brian Boyle as Barry Melrose's favorite player. And and it was well-earned. He was spectacular in that regional. And great call by you, Jeff, on the Petrecki-Jones collision that happened in the first shift or so of last Sunday's regional final. Jess, next question obviously will be for you, and it'll be about North Dakota. Again, a team you've seen more than the rest of us. I think they're in the same position as Boston College in some respects, that they're dangerous enough to win this thing, but maybe not favored when compared to Michigan.
That's a good way to put it. They're in the same position as Boston College, and they're actually in the same game as Boston College, which should be interesting that they're actually going to play. But, no, I look at their lineup, and I don't see a lot of weaknesses. I don't see a lot of glaring holes. They are reliant on one line, but I don't see them being a one-line team. Now, I know there are others participating in this podcast who may disagree with that, and that's fine. But I look at, you know, what they bring out with that second line with Van de Velde and Rylan Kipe, and I think that's as good as anything. Andrew Kozak has had a very good playoffs, so he's been doing some good stuff. Their goalie is as good as it gets right now, and they've got a couple of huge defensemen. So with that said, they seem to kind of hiccup, and they did that a lot in the first half of the year, and, you know, they've been very good in the second half of the year, obviously, but there have been times where they just haven't looked good for whatever reason. I mean, I watched them get beat by Denver in the WCHA Final Five, for example, and it was a very close game, but the fact was they didn't win it. Against Wisconsin in the regional, in the second period, North Dakota looked as bad as I have seen any team look all season. So there are things like that, I guess, that would concern me if I was a Fighting Sioux fan.
Well, that brings us to Notre Dame. Is there, I shouldn't say is there a chance. There, of course there's a chance. What are they going to have to do to beat Michigan, Bus?
Well, I think that one advantage that Notre Dame has is that, you know, I'm going to say they've got two advantages. One is Jeff Jackson. Regardless of, you know, none of these guys ever having played in a Frozen Four on this big stage, Jeff Jackson's been there plenty of times, and he knows, you know, not only what the competition is like at that level, but he knows what it's like to win at that level. The second advantage I think Notre Dame has is who's given them a chance. You know, it's the same advantage that they had when they showed up in Colorado Springs. Everybody expected Notre Dame to be happy to be there, and, you know, they were more than happy to beat New Hampshire and Michigan State, too. So, and I talked with Mark Van Gilder as part of our Q&A series that we've got going on in advance of the Frozen Four, and he alluded to that, saying, hey, you know what, we were kind of squeezing the sticks a little bit just trying to get in to the tournament and kind of secure our spot, and once we got in, it's like, hey, no, nobody expected us to be here, and now that we're here, nobody expects us to do anything other than show up and, you know, make our appearance. What have we got to lose? And I think that that carries over into the Frozen Four.
Back to the first point you made, how much has the Frozen Four changed in scope and magnitude since the last time Jeff Jackson might have been there? Is it a much different tournament than the early 90s? Certainly the media coverage is much bigger. Arenas are bigger. Attendance is higher.
Yeah, I would say that it's changed in those respects. You know, the one thing that I think maybe hasn't changed is the way Jackson's approached the game and prepared his teams for those games. And obviously, you know, he's proven that it's successful. The other thing I think that doesn't change is, you know, when you look at the teams that he had at Lake Superior State, you know, here's this regardless of how good they were, and those teams were outstanding teams, no question, but, you know, here's this small little school from nowhere, Michigan, coming to do battle with these other universities that are 3, 4, 5, 6 times the size. You know, I think he thrives on this us against the world mentality, and, you know, it worked well for him at Lake Superior State, and I think it can work well for him here at Notre Dame. I just in talking with Van Gilder too, you know, he's talked to the guys about, you know, what it's like and, you know, how to stay focused and that type of thing. So he's, you know, he's very patiently and very meticulously and methodically preparing these guys for what they're about to face. And, you know, let's be honest. I mean, Notre Dame, you know, they haven't had a lot of success hockey-wise, but now that they do, I mean, people are going to come out and want to, you know, cover this story because it's Notre Dame. I mean, everybody instantly recognizes that name and knows what it means. And, so, you know, they're dealing with the media now, and they're dealing with the expectations and the talk and the demand. So they're starting to get a little bit of that right now. But, I think that given their situation, they couldn't have a better guy guiding them.
Those are very good points, all very good points.
1994, St. Paul Civic Center, by the way, was the last time Jeff Jackson coached a Frozen Four team. They beat Boston University 9-1 in the title game.
I recall that.
One obvious way that the tournament's changed since then is Notre Dame wouldn't be in the tournament if it was still the same format back then.
Oh, there you go. Exactly.
Yeah. Very good point. One thing that I noticed in Albany was how good Michigan's defense were, or are. One junior, the rest are sophomores and freshmen. Obviously, they have very talented players. That program and that school can attract elite-level college hockey players. But they were so technically sound, and just I don't know that they've gotten enough credit through the year. Billy Sauer, you know, is kind of the backbone, and he's the goalie, and that's where people look, especially based on some of his NCAA tournament history, what he's done in the past. But they were very, very effective in stopping a Clarkson team that has experienced forwards with good size and good speed that were able to generate nothing off the line rush. I mean, absolutely zero. Michigan was fantastic in really neutralizing them, taking that away. Mark Matera is, of course, the leader back there. And going back to the start of the postseason, beginning with the CCHA tournament, Michigan has played 6 games, and in 5 of those, they've allowed 1 goal or 0 goals. And that shutout was against Clarkson last week. The only other game that wasn't was a 6-4 win over Northern Michigan. So I think that Kevin Porter rightfully gets a lot of attention, you know, a lot of the freshman forwards, your Polushais and Pacioretty's and those kinds of people get a lot of attention up front, but their defense to me has not received enough credit for how good they are.
We can certainly change that.
We try to do that a little bit with our regional coverage.
Yes, and I agree. You know, and one thing that you know, I think there's a couple reasons for that. One is obviously there's no Jack Johnson back there, who was kind of, you know, obviously he was the focus, you know, really the last 2 years was, you know, with the skills that he brought to that blue line. But now, you know, they seem like without Johnson, and they seem like a lot more cohesive unit. You know, there's no big names back there, and Matera is really good. I mean, he's All-American caliber, I think, for, you know, first team, no question, in my mind. And obviously we named him our Defenseman of the Year for Inch, you know, the National Defenseman of the Year. But, you know, they're not super involved in the offense. I mean, they do put up some decent numbers, but they're steady. They're really unspectacular. And I guess maybe that's, you know, maybe a defenseman is like a cornerback in that, you know, they're doing their job when you don't notice them.
Right on. Cohesive was exactly the word I was thinking to describe that group as a whole. And speaking of Jack Johnson, I caught a little bit of the LA Kings game on the radio, and they have awards announced, postseason awards that are voted on by all the media. They cover LA, and they voted Johnson as the team's top newcomer and top defenseman right away already this season. So his pro career is off to an outstanding start. And there's a guy who left when he should have left. I mean, there's oftentimes a lot of chatter and how do you adjust to pro signings and is it bad for college hockey when stars leave early? But there's a time when they have to go. And I think Johnson has been a good example for how much college hockey is just right, and when is professional hockey just right for that individual player?
And I think a case in point, and we can talk about somebody who's, you know, recently gone through that experience. Justin Abdelkader at Michigan State. You know, they get bounced by Notre Dame on a Saturday, and on a Thursday he's in the Red Wings lineup.
Yeah,
I mean, sure you'd like to have him stay around for his senior season, but at the same time, I mean, when the Red Wings come calling and want you to sign and are going to put you in the lineup right away and put you on the playoff roster, it's pretty tough to say no to that. That proves that the Spartans are doing their and the coaching staff is doing their job. I mean, they've developed him to play at the next level and advance his career. I mean, and as a recruit, you know, those guys notice that when you see an applicator walk right into to a situation like that, or a Matt Carl, or somebody, you know, guys of that caliber. I mean, sure, they're talented, but they're being prepared for life beyond the college game as well.
Yeah.
Let me ask this, though. Is it a different case with a guy like Kyle Turris, who stayed 1 year of college, and, yeah, he went straight into the NHL lineup, but it was the Phoenix Coyotes lineup, and they're not headed for the playoffs?
I don't think so.
It's a little different.
It's a little different, but look what they're trying to do in Phoenix. I mean, he's going to be one of the guys that they're building around, and they're starting to build. You know, they had a lot of good young guys on that team this year with Mueller, and, Turris is going to be a part of that foundation. And, could he benefit from staying another year? Probably, but, if you're Phoenix, you want to start building that foundation now, and they don't really have, I don't see them having anything to lose by putting him in the lineup, right off, getting him in and having him play. Mueller obviously was ready and had a great year this year, and I think they want to get that organization jump started, and they found some pieces this year, and I think that they're thinking they can bring in Turris and take the next step next year.
Let's go back to speaking a little bit about individual honors and the announcement of the Hobie Hattrick finalists. No surprise to me, at least. I thought that Kevin Porter of Michigan, Nathan Gerby of Boston College, and Ryan Jones from Miami were the three most outstanding candidates from the 10 finalists, and those are the three guys that will be on the stage on Friday when the award is announced and presented. Some discussion that we've seen and read in our email and on our ESPN.com chat involved J.P. Lamoureux and his candidacy. Chess, I know you got to talk to him for a while this week, and you were impressed at how unselfish he was and how non-individual awards-oriented he was. Tell us a little bit about that part of his personality.
The thing that really struck me, not only talking to him, but one thing that strikes you is the kid is a great talker. I mean, and not to say, a big mouth or a loud mouth or anything, he's just very well-spoken. It can tell you everything about the past of his hockey career. Let's face it, he talks in complete sentences, which is sometimes a rarity in this game, but, just a real refreshing kid to talk to, and possibly one or two games left in his college season or his college career. I'm going to miss dealing with a guy like him just from an interview standpoint. But, the bigger picture about him, I play a couple of games in the regional against Princeton. They're up 5-0 with less than a minute left, and kind of a goofy goal sneaks in 5-hole on him. And, you talk to him afterwards, it's like, how disappointing was it to lose that shutout right at the end? The kid could care less. He as long as they've got more goals on their side of the board, he couldn't tell you how many he let in. So that really impressed me, just that it's not about the individual thing at all, or at least it seems to be. And I suppose a lot of goalies would say that, but, with him, for some reason, it just really seems to be him. Now, we got asked a question in the chat this week about the fact that he got, passed over, didn't make the Hobie Hattrick finalists, and, if that's going to inspire him to play better at the Frozen Four. And my honest answer was, I don't think he could care less. I mean, yeah, he's going to want to play great at the Frozen Four, for his team, and knowing that these are his one or two last college games and he wants to win a national championship. The individual stuff, to him it would probably just be a distraction on Friday evening if he had made the top three.
Yeah, it's something that we run into pretty much every year now, and it's how are goalies considered for this award. It's not easy. Everyone kind of takes a different look at it. What do they mean to the team? How would their numbers be if, it was another goalie playing in that system with that personnel? And his numbers were outstanding, Lamoureux. Just fantastic. He had a great season. But to me, one thing that stood out was he wasn't the first-team goalie in his conference. So for those people who see the most games and evaluate the impact that every player in the league makes when you play, I'm pretty sure it's 28 conference games in the WCHA season, for them to pick Bachman over Lamoureux, that to me says great season fantastic, but probably not at the Hobie top three level. So, I don't know. That's just where I stand on that.
I think it's
a fair point.
I think it's an interesting assessment. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I do. But it's got to carry some weight. I agree with you in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah, but we'll see.
We've come a long way from the days where Jamie Ram was a Hobie finalist for Michigan Tech. I think it was in 93 or 94. And I think he had 14 career wins in 4 years. I mean, just never played on a very competitive team. Was an outstanding goaltender. One of these guys who would, you know, by necessity face 45 shots a night. But he was a Hobie finalist that year, and you know that was talked about, that a guy on a team that wasn't very good was considered one of the top 10 players.
In some of the coverage and just general college hockey interest, I went back and looked at the list of Hobie finalists in recent years and years gone by. Those are all published at Inside College Hockey. If you're looking for a quick reference, under the history section, and you know. I think it's a huge compliment to the development, ability to attract top-level players and the growth of many programs from across the nation at the high level of players that are mentioned among this year's Hobie finalists and even the last 2 to 3 years, because there were some years maybe in the, I don't know, 98 to 2001 era or two that, man, you know, like, man, these guys weren't that good. I just didn't think of them in that light. But I think it's something that you can read into a little bit and certainly salute the programs from around the country who are able to attract these kinds of players. Jeff, we've talked all season long about Nathan Gerby and his candidacy. I think the voters made a statement by having Gerby among the top three vote getters. And for people who are unclear about the selection process, the Hobie Award winner has already been determined. They don't vote again after the three finalists are named. What the voters vote for their top candidates out of the 10, they just announce the three that were the top vote getters for the ceremonial aspect of the award. But obviously, if there were any character issues or question marks about Gerby, I think the voters spoke to the fact that what he does on the ice is certainly respected and appreciated.
Yeah, it was definitely the right call. This kid is clearly one of the three best players in the country. Like I said earlier, I would be hard-pressed to believe he's not the most valuable player in the country. Anybody who's ever seen him play knows that he's extremely exciting to watch. He is, you know, if you're going out to find one player to watch in the country right now, I mean, I'd find two better players to, you know, pick right now than Ryan Jones and Nathan Gerby. And he's a game changer. He paces the attitude of that team and the drive of the forwards. He's so good that, you know, character issues, I think he, as I wrote earlier this season when I went really in-depth there, I think Ben Smith hit it on the head. He is in the spotlight because he's one of the best players in the country, and refs and everybody else are going to target in and watch what he's doing, and they're going to kind of nitpick, and they're going to see him, you know, do the same sort of things that everybody else in the game is doing. Everybody's butt-ending. Everybody's doing things to get an edge. And he has to do those things for him to be that good. I mean, if you show me a soft hockey player, I'll show you a hockey player who isn't going to have a good career. I mean, people get criticized for being soft and diving and things like that. And, you know, I don't want to name names, but, you know, there are a few players in Hockey East right now who are extremely talented players, but if you ask what's the most glaring thing that you know about that player, somebody's going to say that they're soft or they're not physical enough. So it would be really hypocritical for those type of people to criticize Gerby and his style of play just because he goes out there and he, you know, cliche. He gives 100% every time he's out there. He's trying to get any advantage he can, and he should, because he's 5'5" and, you know, 140 pounds soaking wet, or or 175, whatever it is he's listed at. So I think Joe Vertanian made a very strong comment about Gervie's character earlier this season when I was talking to him about Nathan, and he said that anybody who is going to hold a postseason award back from Gervie because of, you know, things that people have said about his play on the ice shouldn't be voting for this type of an award. It's a fair claim. It was blown up a lot earlier this season, but, you know, Gervie hasn't been on anybody's radar since then, and, you know, he's a great kid off the ice. He really is. You know, the things that he does on the ice are what makes him such a great player, so... You know, that, you know, long diatribe aside, he definitely deserves to be one of the Hobie finalists.
I agree. Plus, in watching Kevin Porter a little more closely, and of course it was a two-game sample size, but to me it looked like his best skill was being in the right place at the right time. And as I told some other people, it seems the kind of guy, and he had that kind of weekend in Albany where if he were to walk down the hallway and stub his toe, it's because he'd be tripping on a $50 bill. You know, just everything kind of went his way. Is that fair? Is that accurate?
That's a good point, and I think it is to a certain extent that everything goes your way, but it goes your way because of the way you see the game, and because of hard work, and because of preparation. And I think that those things are what makes Kevin Porter the kind of player he is. I think that his skills are just so well-rounded, and I've probably beat it to death over the past 3+ years about how good he is defensively. You know, if he ends up in the NHL, and I think he probably will, you know, if they say, okay, you're going to be our checking line center, you're going to shadow, you know, the other team's top offensive player, I mean, he's going to be good at that. Or if they're going to say, you're going to be a two-way guy and play some power, you know, whatever position you put him in, he's going to excel because, you know, I think, first of all, he is willing to accept whatever role that he's given based on, you know, what's best for the team. And I think he's worked really hard to become a well-rounded player. And I think that that's kind of what sets him apart, is just how, you know, obviously he's got the offensive numbers. And obviously he's got the line mates to help him put those numbers up, but he is just so good in all facets of the game that I think that's what gives him the edge and makes people think, well, he sure was in the right place at the right time. Well, there's a reason he was there, and it wasn't luck. It's because of the preparation and the way he sees the game.
Yeah, when I think of his pro career, to me he projects as kind of a Jeff Halpern type, you know, a guy who can get some points, and he'll get them because he will, but that's not what he's, you know, going to be known for when it comes to a league-wide reputation. More likely to certainly be a Selke finalist for best defensive forward, you know, in his career, and I could absolutely see that happening. He is a Colorado Avalanche draft pick, which is another little side note that has relevance this week with the games being played at the Pepsi Center.
He's something else. He is a good player. But is he probably the Hobie Baker winner? I'm going to say yes. Is he the most exciting player in college hockey? No, I think it's Gervie, hands down.
I think there are actually several more. Yeah.
I think there's no question about it that Gervie is the most exciting player.
I'd vote for Gervie, having seen him at the Dodge Classic in Minnesota over the holidays. He was far and away the best player on the ice. And, you know, compare all you will, but he reminded me of what Brian Gionta looked like as a freshman. You know, just a dynamic guy that, you know, your eye just went to him as soon as he was on the ice. Or, you know, almost like Korea was maybe a little bit too, that he was what you watched when he was playing.
Yeah, good call there. Yeah, I think in terms of excitement and a guy you're going to notice and bring into your feet, I think both of the other Hobie finalists, Hobie hat-trick finalists, are probably that guy more than Porter. But I think Kevin Porter is the best player this season in college hockey.
And one thing, another thing, since we're talking about these three guys, and I know, you know, ESPN's broadcasts kind of get criticized because, you know, they like to take the storylines and kind of, you know, instead of letting the game unfold and kind of determining it, you know, letting their broadcasts kind of follow that story instead of kind of going in to, and saying, here's what we want to follow. But, you know, for them to focus on Jones for Miami, I mean, he's a phenomenal player. I mean, he's big, he's strong, he's tough, he's got all the skills, great hands, great shot. So for them to focus in on him and, you know, really kind of pick apart his game for the people who were lucky enough to see Miami play was, you know, just really kind of hammered home why he's one of those three guys, I think. And I think he deserves it, too. And you can make a case for Lamoureux, no question. But, you know, Jones is, he's a remarkable player. He really is.
If North Dakota were to lose Lamoureux or Oshie, which would hurt North Dakota more, Jess?
If they were to lose one of the two?
Yeah.
I think on about Sunday they're going to lose both, but... boy, that's a tough question. I mean, I guess I would have to say Lamoureux, just based on this fact that they've played Boston College 2 years in a row in the Frozen Four, and they've given up a total of 12 goals in those two games. They've given up 6 goals a game. Now, you know, you can score, but can you score 7 to win in the Frozen Four semis? So I think goaltending is probably more important. And I think they have enough complementary offensive parts that, yeah, losing Oshie would hurt, and, you know, he's been banged up and has missed games over his career, and it's hurt, but it hasn't put them into a complete tailspin.
Right. I think that's the right answer, too.
My kids just got kicked out of the World Hockey Camp thanks to that answer, by the way. I appreciate it.
No problem. No problem.
Jess, I'm interested to know what, and I've seen the BC side of it, what is North Dakota's mentality heading into this? You know, Boston College, again, which has ended its season in 2 straight Frozen Fours.
You know, having just talked to Lamoureux, they claim, you know, hey, they love it. Let's give us one more crack at them. I'm not going to accuse anybody of BS or anything, but it just seems to me like, you know, a certain number of them have got to be looking at this bracket and going, not again. Not that they're not, you know, capable of winning that game, and not that it won't be a very good game, but I would think you'd just get tired of it after a couple of years. And, you know, if you're a goalie, why would you want to have to face Nathan Gerby to get to the national championship game?
I think Boston College is obviously, you know, licking its chops from the outside of it. I mean, they've beaten North Dakota, I think, was 3 straight years now in the tournament, twice in the Frozen Four.
Yeah.
Both times, you know, if not the game of the year, the college hockey season, you're looking at probably one of the 3 or 4 best games of the whole entire season. And, you know, the only difference for BC this year is they're going into it without Corey Schneider, I would say. You know, obviously, a Brian Boyle and a Chris Collins and, you know, a couple guys like that would be missed. But I think BC is amped up. It knows that North Dakota is going to come out strong, you know. But along the other lines, if you need any extra motivation to win a Frozen Four game, then you're probably playing the wrong sport.
Yeah, we got a question kind of similar to that in our chat about the rivalry and what goes on. I don't think it's a rivalry in terms of, you know, the names change every year is what I'm trying to say, and the rosters change every year, but for those programs to be at that level, they understand. I'm sure there's a respect more than a rivalry to know that they've played big games, and when they match up against that other team, that there's something worth playing for on the line. So I'm glad that matchup has worked out to produce these games over the past several years.
It's interesting you mentioned that. In researching the regionals, I had to look up when the last time Minnesota and Boston played. I think of those as two pretty complementary programs and similar programs. They hadn't played since, like, 2002, which amazed me because it seems to me like North Dakota and BC play, you know, twice a year. Well, once in the regular season and once in the Frozen Four.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they obviously are very familiar with each other. They, you know, they two-thirds of a game this year. So, hey, old friends, let's get together.
Yeah. One would have, you know, it's a moot point now, but you were looking last weekend at the potential of seeing BC and North Dakota, which is, I guess, an unnatural rivalry, you know, just one that has been created of sorts because of the Frozen Four in the NCAA tournament. And then you were looking at the other side of things. You could have seen Michigan-Michigan State, which is, of course, a natural rivalry because of the conference and location and all the other things that come with it. So I thought that would have been really interesting. Two very different types of rivalries. Obviously, Michigan State couldn't answer the bill on that one.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned, Jess, that North Dakota played two-thirds of a game against BC because they also played two-thirds of a game against Wisconsin last Sunday.
As I mentioned earlier, North Dakota looked like they had their bags packed and they're just ready to go home in that second period and just lifeless. But to their credit, they showed the quick strike nature of their offense in the third that bang, bang, two shifts, the game's tied.
Well, let's go back to Wisconsin.
Anytime.
They won a game. Yeah, they won a game. And I think some of the maybe natural reaction was, ha-ha, look at us, we won a game in the tournament. That still does not mean that you belonged in it.
No,
it
does not.
That is all.
Here's my reaction to that. So?
Yeah.
They won a game. Give them credit. I mean, they played well. They played better than Denver. And
so did Clarkson. So did Michigan State. And so did Miami.
Yeah. 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 So leave St. Cloud State home next year. No, I'm kidding.
More than the fact that Wisconsin was in the tournament, the fact that they were a 3 seed, the thing that really kills me, and I don't know, I mean, it's just, there's got to be something done, and I don't understand why this is some sort of rule. It makes no sense. Just because a team is hosting or a school is hosting a regional, there is absolutely no reason for that team to be locked into that quadrant of the tournament. I mean, Wisconsin sneaking in is one thing. The fact that they got to play a game on their home ice, same with Colorado College, that rule has to be changed. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
I disagree to an extent. I think that it's probably better for each regional site if it is that way. Is it better for the integrity of the tournament? Certainly not. But I just seeing 3,800 people in Albany, New York, you know, cheering for Michigan and Clarkson, that doesn't really have a true championship vibe to it. I mean, St. Cloud and Maine playing in Rochester on a Friday afternoon, I mean, come on. And
there was some, speaking to that topic at the WCHA Final Five, I mean, Bob Motzko of St. Cloud State, who was, you know, a longtime assistant at Minnesota, talked about that, and this is more of a WCHA thing to a certain extent, but the fact that you go from the Final Five, where, you know, you play a third-place game on a Saturday afternoon and it's still got 14,000 people there, which is, you know, a great atmosphere to watch hockey. There's bands, there's all that. Motzko mentioned, you know, a week later, and he was referencing specifically 2004, a week later, it's Minnesota versus Minnesota Duluth in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and if there were 2,000 people in there, it would be a surprise. I was one of them. It was nice and quiet. And it's just interesting that you go from a great atmosphere and then the stakes get bigger, but the atmosphere drops in a lot of cases. So I'm all for, you know, having the home team or the host team play at home. But Jeff, I guess I would disagree and say they're not locked into their home venue because they have to make the tournament first. You know, there was, you know, last year, for example, the regional in Denver. Denver didn't make it. You know, so you don't get a guarantee other than, you know, if you're in the top 16 teams in the country, you're the top 11 or whatever it is, you get to play a home game.
You know what is one that is interesting to me is when host sites now are represented in the host institution is a conference rather than a school itself, or in the case of next year's Frozen Four, the U.S. Naval Academy, they don't have a hockey team.
Right.
You know, so I think that is a trend that is probably appreciated. And the problem you have in the West is there aren't a lot of buildings that are suitable regional venues that are not on campus. You know, and Jeff, I'm sure you would agree that if Michigan, I'll say Western Michigan, is the host school in Grand Rapids, it's not at Lawson Arena in Kalamazoo. It's not at their home rink. It's at a, you know, or if Rensselaer hosts in Albany, it's not at Houston Fieldhouse, you know, which is different than if BU hosts in Worcester, but they're not playing at Gannis. I think you would prefer a situation like that, I trust.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, you know, this tournament is one of the many that the NCAA doesn't run correctly. You know, the lacrosse tournament's a joke. The 1AA football tournament's a joke. The BCS is a joke.
NCAA doesn't run that.
There are portions of, you know, this one that hit a lot of people off.
How many credentials did we request? I just want to make sure.
I agree with Jeff's theoretical argument that, you know, in a perfect world it wouldn't be that way. I don't think anybody disagrees. But you know, that said, I'm going off of memory here, which is, you know, coin flip at best. But I don't think there were 10,000 people in the building either night for those games in Madison. Which is more of an indictment of the fans in Wisconsin than it is of hosting, you know, or of the site selection. But
at the Saturday game, plus it was, you know, I would say there were 10,000-11,000 maybe in a 15,000 seat building. I will say this though, the atmosphere was really good. I mean, the fans that were there were noisy, and I still, and you know, and I've said this for a long time, Wisconsin hockey fans, and I saw this again. Let me back up. Not Wisconsin hockey fans. Wisconsin Badger fans are great fans, but I have never thought them to be great hockey fans. I mean, they come out and they cheer for the Red, and they still to this day, I mean, and this is a generalization and it's maybe unfair, but there's still a large portion of the fan base, I think, at the Kohl Center that doesn't really understand the nuances of the game and doesn't appreciate the history of the game like they do at some other schools, but they come out and they cheer. And the one quick example I'll use of this is Denver, you know, there's a penalty upcoming on Wisconsin early in the game. Peter Menino comes sprinting out of the net, and a guy sitting right next to the press box stands up and yells, "Shoot the puck, the net's empty!" I'm like, oh, guys, you just don't get it. But hey, they, you know, I thought the atmosphere was good. The band was there, the students were loud. No, it was not sold out. I think tickets were something like, you know, they were considerably more than what students pay during the rest of the season, so that may have kept some people away, but you're right. It wasn't sold out.
I can appreciate the app, you know, and Boss, you were right, it is one of those arguments that is better, you know, in a perfect world, this is how it would be run, but, and I do appreciate the argument of the atmosphere, and, you know, other than, you know, the BU-BC game in the Worcester Regional 2 years ago, of the four, you know, quarterfinal, semifinal regionals that I've covered in the last 4 years, I've never really been impressed with the atmosphere in any of the games. And, you know, one was in Amherst, two were in Worcester, and one was in Manchester. So, you know, I guess it's definitely true that, you know, if you're going to keep a team closer to your campus, then obviously you're going to draw those fans a lot more than you would than, you know, if you send a team like UNH to Colorado Springs. You know, those fans can't necessarily afford to make the plane ride out there.
I think some of the two of my favorite championship games were actually when Minnesota played at the Xcel Energy Center and Wisconsin played at the Bradley Center. I mean, I thought that was fantastic because it was a full, loud, exciting building.
I would agree.
Back on the topic of regionals, though, Mike, let me ask you this, because you were in Green Bay for which was a pseudo neutral site, but let's face it, it was Wisconsin's home territory. What was the atmosphere like there with them playing Cornell? I mean, was it like a home game for Wisconsin, or was there a certain neutral element to it?
That's a good question. It was.
And what was the crowd like? I mean, were they sold out for those?
They were. If they weren't, they were very close.
Okay.
The atmosphere wasn't bad for that, for either game, or for either day, I should say. Yep. One thing that helped was that obviously Wisconsin had a band there. Cornell had their band there. And bands make a huge difference as far as, livening up the atmosphere in the rink.
Absolutely.
And part of it, one thing that didn't help was the fact that the game was horribly boring. that regional final was, at least. But it had more of a feel of neutrality, I think, than playing, obviously, at the Cole Center, or even at the Bradley Center. I mean, and maybe it's just being in Green Bay and you're a little bit away and from those two big population centers, but it didn't strike me as overly Bucky-centric in either case.
You prefer pep bands to Cotton Eye Joe and the Cha-Cha song?
Yes.
I've said this
and
many times before.
But let me...
During games... go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I've said this before, and I'll be quick. When I'm running college hockey, which, let's face it, it's not too far away, Cotton Eye Joe will be banned from the game.
I don't know. Like, JP Lammer was dancing to it. Did you see him on that? Did you see that photo?
I did. Yeah.
One thing I will say, for about as neutral a venue as you could get, which was Denver last year, thinking of the teams that were out there, Michigan and Minnesota and North Dakota and Air Force, I guess, ending up to be the de facto home team, great atmosphere. For both days. Minnesota and North Dakota, obviously, you're going to have a great atmosphere. And those fans, A, travel well, B, they're, Minnesota fans come out of the woodwork, it seems, wherever they play. Air Force had a great showing, and, I was in Worcester, and I can imagine that they probably don't travel too well. But great atmosphere, the buildings... I don't remember the attendance, but it was I was fairly surprised at the attendance both days. And the home, the fans showed up. So,
yeah, it was well over five, Jess. I think it was 13, okay. Right, Buzz?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were big crowds both nights.
Yeah. And that bodes well for this weekend. That city will embrace and support this event.
Speaking of pep bands, thumbs up to the Princeton band for making the trip to Madison. Great to have them there. And if you've never seen the Princeton band, they come out wearing orange plaid, which I didn't know existed, but God bless them.
It does.
If you go deer hunting in Scotland, that's what you would wear.
Jeff, how did Air Force travel?
By plane.
Oh, thanks.
Serve that one up. Wow.
Hey, that was one timer.
Yeah. Air Force, they had fans there. No, there was no band.
No, that's just...
Fans were at least in double digits, so you got to give them that. But, I can't imagine Air Force has one of the most diehard fan bases. There were a few there.
What other school do they make you take an oath? Come on. Talk about a diehard fan base.
Yeah,
you bet your life on it.
Pun intended.
Gotcha.
The thing about that game, though, was the fact that by the time, because that was the first game, so the building was pretty slow and, dreary at the beginning of that game. When the third period was going and, the play really picked up, Miami started... an onslaught of an attack with about 12 to 13 minutes to go before they ended up tying it up and winning it in overtime. every fan in that building, Minnesota, BC, and, you know, the 30 from Air Force, were rooting heavily for Air Force. And, you know, that's when it kind of got exciting. So the Air Force fans didn't really travel well. I'm not blaming them or anything like that. I know very little about their fan base, but the building was really fun just because everybody in there, you know, except for the Miami fans, were pulling for the upset.
I'm going back in history, by the way. Last year, for that first day of the regional, the West Regional in Denver, they pulled in 11,171. And that was for Air Force and Minnesota. And what was the other game? North Dakota and Michigan.
North Dakota.
So, and I don't know what they pulled. There was more people there the second day. And the second day was about 30 degrees nicer than the first day. I know that. The weather was abysmal for the first day. I mean, it was 40 and foggy and rainy. And for the title game,
I do know that in talking with our friends at the University of Denver, I do know that 18 months ago or so, if you had contacted the University of Denver, if you were a corporation in Denver and you had contacted them about getting tickets, you were leaned on pretty heavily to buy a bunch of regional tickets in order to get Frozen Four tickets. So, you know, there may have been a few corporate ticket holders who didn't actually use their seats, but hey, whatever.
No, I honestly, having been there, I think the numbers were pretty representative of fans in the seats. I mean, it was pretty good, both days.
Good deal. Well, I hope it's the same. Hope it's the same this weekend.
Bus, you mentioned weather. Bring a coat, Frozen Four attendees. Temperatures in the 40s throughout the week in Denver. A little nicer on Saturday, according to the current forecast. So check it out before you leave and dress appropriately.
Do we have a powder report from Vail?
We're not there for skiing. We're there for hockey.
Filmmaking going on?
Right.
I thought you were there for baseball. Come on.
Well, I am.
it's just all about the experience.
That's a coincidence. Unintended coincidence.
That's a great bounce. Is what it is.
It is. That is a great bounce.
It's got a great bounce on
it. But I have to say, having lived in Denver, that regardless of what the weather is like, and I don't think it's, you know, judging from the forecast, it's not going to be too terrific. This really is the worst weather of the year in Colorado is spring, because, you know, it can literally be 30 and snowing one day, and the next day it'll be 65 and sunny. I mean, it's just. And I don't know why it is, but this time of the year, you know, March and April and in early May, just terrible weather. Unpredictable and cold and crappy and precipitation-y. But, you know, the rest of the year is pretty good. But if you haven't been there, you'll love it. I guarantee. And if you don't, you're stupid. So, not my fault. I can't help it if you're dumb.
Another interesting development. This was discussed on NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman has an hour-long radio show called NHL This Week or something.
way to go.
Yeah, pretty clever, snappy title. Really grabs your attention. Probably why I can't remember it. But
gong show.
But it's really interesting and commendable. He goes on an hour with Bill Clement as a co-host or moderator, and he just more or less takes calls for an hour on XM Radio every week, and the producers who, you know, screen the calls and patch them through. They certainly have done a nice job. It's not all softballs, you know, and there are some thoughtful questions and suggestions that come from this. And they were talking about the playoff scheduling, which is going to be a little bit difficult. That'll be announced over, you know, tonight and the next day or so with the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs starting Wednesday. But you've got a situation where the Colorado Avalanche occupy a building that they're not going to have available to them for 4 days this week. And we run into the same thing next year in Washington. So it, that that's a little thing to consider. I remember there was kind of some overlap when the Bruins played at 04 when they hosted that Frozen.
That's right.
But, yeah, it's tough. But
that was the one that Joe Thornton didn't show up. Or, no, he was hurt. Was he not hurt? Played hurt.
That's what got him traded.
Cool. But the good news
there were
the
things.
This guy, we cannot build a franchise around.
Yeah.
There were things that got Joe Thornton traded that, you know, cannot be talked about. It had nothing to do with playing hurt or not playing hurt.
Awesome.
You can't say that and then just leave it.
Yeah,
we'll talk about it after the podcast is done recording.
Find me.
Podcast after dark.
So enjoy that one, Inch listeners.
Yeah, find me in Denver.
We're going to be talking about you after school.
But I...
Find me in Denver.
But I'm the guy with the Boston accent.
But I'm not as tall as Jerry York.
But speaking of scheduling, I mean, it won't be too bad for the Avalanche because they're on the road to start.
They start on the road, yeah.
Their first home game of the playoffs is the 14th, so they're in good shape.
And obviously, Inch has an interest in the Washington Capitals, and I haven't seen their schedule yet. But I did hear that the Circus was in Philly. They play Philadelphia in the first round, so there was some hang up with the scheduling the Philly portion of the playoffs because of the Circus. Probably those people
Actually,
that watch Philadelphia think the Circus is always in Philly, but.
Are we advocating neutral site NHL playoff games?
No.
That tournament sucks. They've been screwing it up for 100 years.
What I'm saying is, if you have an NHL team, don't put the frickin' Circus in your building in mid-April.
Hey, you know what, though? When the Caps did that 3 weeks ago and had it going on a little six-game road trip, it didn't work out too badly for them. They ended with three at home, all must wins, and they all were wins, and they won the Southeast Division.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying. Perfect world, you wouldn't put the
But, you know, that's big time entertainment, and they need to sell popcorn. And
while you're at it, kick the Wizards out too.
If it's Dora the Explorer or Washington Wizards or Alex Ovechkin or, you know, Barnum and Bailey, doesn't matter. We got to get people in the building.
Bus, you'll remember this, but 1984, when Minnesota Duluth won its first WCHA title, they get to write the right to. The playoffs, which I don't think they had before, had very rarely before. Yeah, and it just so happened that the deck, their home arena, was booked with like a home and garden show that week. And first time they ever get to host the WCHA playoff championship, it wasn't at a neutral site then; it was just at arena, local arenas. They get to host North Dakota, and they don't have an arena to do it in. They actually had to move the games to Minneapolis. They played at the arena. Sold them out. I mean, they had thousands of Duluth fans who drove down to see the games. But, hey, that's tough when you play in a building you don't control.
Something happened.
How long
like
that
to drive? Ohio State last year.
Ohio State
that's
hockey?
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. They had to play at the OSU ice rink, I think.
Yeah, they did.
Because of, I want to say, girls basketball.
Yeah, high school state.
That actually happened.
The men, Ohio State men's basketball team this year, they in the NIT.
Yeah.
Little
John Arena.
Yeah, Bruce Springsteen was playing at VCA, so they had to go to St. John Arena.
St. John Arena, yeah.
And
well, and I wrote about that in one of my late season notebooks. That you know, that's one issue Wisconsin's had to deal with since the Kohl Center opened. Is Wisconsin hockey is essentially on the road. For about the last 3 weeks of the season, pretty much every season. I mean, they occasionally have a home series, but with men's and women's basketball playing there, with women's hockey conflicts, and then with high school sports all being played at the Kohl Center, they end up ending the season on the road, you know, pretty regularly.
And that goes back to the point that we never really flushed out, but especially in the West, there aren't a lot of good buildings to have those types of events. I mean, you look at those American League markets, you know, like Albany, Worcester, Springfield, Manchester, Bridgeport, Rochester.
Yep.
that can host those events that are non-campus venues that are still close to a lot of places. In the West, there really isn't. I mean, there's Milwaukee and Grand Rapids. You know, who hosts if you have it in Chicago?
Right.
You know? And you're
Des Moines,
not going to go to Iowa.
The AHL, yeah,
you're not
going
to go to
the AHL building. You go there.
Or Houston or San Antonio.
Right. You know, you're not going to go to Peoria or...
Yeah, exactly. Quad right. City, Iowa.
You could go to Rockford, I suppose, if you wanted, but there's really no reason.
Yeah, well, again, who?
I've been there.
Notre Dame?
Notre Dame would be Chicago, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Notre Dame, in theory, could host something in Chicago.
You know, the other place that would work for Notre Dame is Fort Wayne.
Yeah.
Which has got a cool old building that seats, if I want to say, about 8,000. You know, you'd probably have to put two CCHA teams in there to work, and one of them would probably have to be a Michigan or a Michigan State. It would probably, and I don't know much about the city of
Fort Wayne. Is there a minimum size? Is there a minimum size in... number of seats you have to have?
I'm sure there is.
I think there is, and I don't know it off the top of my head. I want to say it's 6 or 7,000.
Yeah, because Colorado has about 7,000, and they've obviously hosted
recently. I wouldn't be surprised to see Omaha host one.
Yeah.
At some point. So they had basketball.
Quest Center.
At the, they've actually had quite a few, I think, quite a few events in Omaha.
They have a little baseball tournament there every summer.
Yeah, they do. NCAA seems to like how that's working out.
Yeah.
Why don't we do that? Why don't we go to a permanent site for the Frozen Four?
I think that may be the direction they go at the Division III level. I really do.
Have it at the same location every year? Or maybe rotate between East and West?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Yeah.
I think it's the right answer. They're still trying to find an answer, but I think that one makes sense. And when Lake Placid hosted this year, at the beginning of the season at least, a lot of people said, let's hope that we can maybe make this a permanent destination. And, you know, and it makes for better, I mean, if you're into those hokey slogans and, you know, bumper stickers and signs and, you know, destination Lake Placid, you know where you're trying to get to, you know, every year. When you tell a college baseball fan Omaha, Nebraska, it means something to them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, we'll see what happens.
Speaking of Frozen Four venues, I don't know if we ever ran this, but there was a great shirt this fan in Madison at the regional that was wearing. A guy from someplace in Iowa, our photographer talked to him, had a T-shirt on that said, NCAA, no gimmick hockey. And on the back it said, the Joe, not Ford Field.
No, we did not run that photo, but yes, yeah. I did see that.
Yeah, good stuff.
Well,
and
I wholeheartedly agree. Let's stay in downtown Detroit.
I didn't really pay close attention to what went on in the basketball regionals. I guess that was last weekend.
Because you're smart.
Well, there's that. And I have to admit, though, I did watch about the last 10 minutes of Kansas and North Carolina yesterday.
That's nice.
So, but anyway, that was after the Caps game, man. Obviously, but
yes, it was. By the way, during the recording of this podcast, the Caps playoff schedule has been announced.
All right, can we?
They will open their playoff series Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern, which would be a fantastic tailgate event prior to the Inch Bash.
5 o'clock. We'll have to
be a little happy hour event during the Frozen Four.
Maybe we should. Make something happen along with that.
I can think of something that can happen along with that.
I will bring my
drink a beer and watch a game.
I will bring my Caps shirt.
As will I.
Now I officially have something to wake up for on Friday.
Well, there is that.
Rook's Frozen Four usually involves. I got to set my alarm so I can see the sunset.
he's bumming because the championship game is at 5 local time. He saw that and he's like, this is going to be a close call.
That hurts. I am going to have to set my alarm now.
Can I get a wake-up call for 4:45?
He'll be in the media hospitality room like, where's the scrambled eggs and bacon?
I've actually had 7 scrambled eggs in the last about 36 hours, so I think we need to not talk about scrambled eggs and bacon.
What the heck?
Right now.
What's your problem?
Ask my stomach.
So they're gonna. The first game of that series is Friday.
Friday, then Sunday at 2. Oof. Should wrap up before the end of the Masters.
Yes, it should.
The series shifts to Philly for Tuesday-Thursday games next week. Then Game 5 would be in Washington on Saturday at 1. That sounds like an NBC game, if necessary.
So not necessary is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's in the Eastern Conference, so it almost has to be on NBC.
Yeah. Well, of course, the
I was kind of hoping, actually, that they'd end up playing Ottawa, not just because Ottawa's been in the tank, but so some of those games would end up on CBC.
Well, the Caps won all 4 regular season meetings against the Senators.
That's right.
And, you know, we've got ties, as we mentioned, to the Washington Capitals, but if you haven't seen these, and especially the folks maybe that are listening out west, make time to watch this team play hockey. They are fantastic. And you talk about doing things the right way. That's a team who goes out and plays to win.
Yep.
You know, and it's refreshing in a 10-year era of the New Jersey Devils and Dallas Stars and Minnesota Wilds, you know, shortening games and trying to play as little hockey as possible.
I'm sorry, were you talking about the Northwest Division champions? Just wanted to check. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I was.
I haven't bought the hat yet, but I may have it in Denver.
All right. You know, this is a team that really gets after it and attacks and looks to score. They've got, of course, everyone knows the name of Ovechkin. The rookie centerman that he plays with, Nicklas Backstrom, will be in the Hall of Fame. He's that good. He's fantastic. His vision, his creativity, and the skill to execute, you know, what he sees and make it happen is right up there. Semin's a guy who'll drive you crazy. You know, you hate him if you're a coach, but his offensive talent is undeniable.
I think you even hate him if you're a fan, because he can just be maddening to watch, and then he'll just do something ridiculous.
His goal last night was insane.
Yes.
Insane. So, you know, and then there's the Fedorovs, and they got some guys who work hard, and like Brooks Like. We're still seeking the second member of the Brooks Like fan club. We'll reopen the membership call.
Maybe you can have a drive, membership drive after. You can do a
They'll all come on board when the Conn Smythe trophy gets presented.
Chris Pronger?
Yeah.
Backing up just briefly to the talk about wake-up calls, going to the Frozen Four reminds me of one of my favorite sports columnists from one of the Minneapolis papers. Used to be a heavy drinker, has been sober for like 20 years, but he tells a story about covering it.
No.
Yeah, shocker. Covering a Super Bowl in New Orleans or Miami or someplace like that, and said, you know, Saturday night before the Super Bowl or Sunday morning before the Super Bowl, he's stumbling back to his hotel after an all-night bender and noticed the sun was coming up, plopped himself into his hotel bed, reached over, called the front desk, said, I'd like a 7:30 wake-up call, please. Pause on the line. The woman says, sir, it's 8:15.
Good times.
That's how we roll.
That's how we roll.
I'm excited about these. I mean, I'm excited about the Frozen Four, but I'm excited about the NHL playoffs, too.
Yeah, it'll be a good one.
Fired up.
Get her going.
Go
it's always
Caps,
nice.
Go.
Yeah. Go Caps and go Wilds. Don't let us slow down those Wilds.
They do that just fine by themselves.
They do that just fine themselves.
Right.
Can I say, maybe we should do a... Well,
NHL Stanley Cup podcast?
Well, I think we might have to, but...
I think we probably will, to be honest.
Yeah, I think we probably will, too. But I'm just...
Season ends, we kind of like to talk about hockey still. That's what we do.
Well, you've got obviously, college guys playing...
Oh, yeah.
...important roles. I was just thinking that when I was watching the Caps last night... Did you watch them last night, or...?
Oh, yeah.
Thinking of that, looking... Fedorov scored the second goal for Washington to make it... That made it 2-1.
Awesome.
Yeah, great goal. Like, 96-type goal.
That goal is going to be part of Washington Capitals history.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They're going to show that for 20 years, and everyone's going to know what that goal meant and what it was.
But
and that to me is great.
When I watch
lore,
him play,
part of the lore.
It will be.
Not quite lore yet.
Yeah.
Okay.
Lore.
Just checking.
But when I watch him play now, I mean, he I think he, you know, Fedorov playing with Ovechkin has completely rejuvenated him. I mean, that's not sayable.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have to be a genius to figure that out. You know, but they're, you know, obviously they're good for each other. And I think.
And they don't play on the same line.
No. They're on the power play together.
Yeah.
But
it's also Kozlov and Semin and, you know, even a guy like Matt Cook, you know, that I think that whole energy, that whole fun thing. And he has helped them.
Matt
His
Cook
veteran knows. Presence has really helped them.
Yeah.
He does things the right way.
Don't say that to Vinny LeCavalier.
Who?
Are you talking about Matt Cook, or are we talking about...
I was talking about Fedorov.
Oh, yes, you're right. No, Matt Cook was catching some heat for taking out Vinny.
That was bogus.
What he did?
The comments about it. The only call on that play is interference with Cavalier. That's it. Cook's making a line of the puck here. LeCavalier cuts right in front of him and turns into him.
Yep.
And it wasn't the hit, and LeCavalier said this on the record, it wasn't the hit that caused the injury, it was him hitting the ice is what caused the injury. So, I don't know. But that's over and done with. LeCavalier have plenty of time to heal.
Yes, he will.
And Matt Cook was lost to Vancouver last year in that Anaheim series in the second round, and it really made a difference for the Canucks. They needed him. Especially with the abrasive style that Anaheim plays. So
and that would have been right in his wheelhouse.
It wouldn't have made a difference in the outcome of the series. It probably would have gone an extra game or so.
Was that a 5-gamer?
I think it was.
We're getting ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah, that's for a different podcast.
Are we going to podcast from the Mile High City?
We'll try.
have we podcasted at altitude? Do we know how it might affect the podcast?
Yeah.
We do not.
You might get the bends. That's another handy tip we should maybe throw out to our podcast listeners. Maybe should have said it at the beginning because people tuned out, but... would you go from sea level up to altitude and you drink alcohol, it's going to be quicker to get drunk. It will not take you as long.
Maybe consider the 12-pack instead of the 18-pack. See how it goes.
It'll get on you. It's a forecheck. Get on you a little
It'll
quicker.
It'll get on you, yeah.
The beer has good jump out there.
It'll get after you.
I think you might find yourself fighting the puck a little earlier than usual. And Rook's been known to fight the puck.
With that bit of advice, any other advice, closing thoughts, further deterioration? Perfect. Last call then. We thank you for listening to an InsideCollegeHockey.com podcast. Enjoy the Frozen Four and continue to check out InsideCollegeHockey.com for more coverage leading up to this weekend's games in Denver.